welcome to Comic Talk today for Thursday, May the 10th. God, this year is flying by. It is Thursday, and it is time for me to sit on my comfy couch and get some therapy. Comfy Couch, trademark Nerd Legion Podcast 2018. Joining me today, Ed Moore from, how many podcasts do you do at any given point?
Currently, I think I have four active, but truly only two are active, so.
Well, you're still doing Mighty Thor cast, because you just had an episode, what, like a month and a half ago?
Yeah, and actually I do, and I know a lot of people who listen to my other shows might find this hard to believe, but I do a non-comic book podcast as well.
What?
It has nothing to do with geek, nerd, comic culture at all.
Blasphemy.
I know. That's why I keep it on the down low.
That's not a thing. There's nothing but comics. Don't you read the news? All they talk about is comics.
But the problem is, in order for me to believe that, I have to do a podcast with my wife. So that's the trade-off.
See, I did not know this. Now I need to find it.
It's called Dance Fever.
Oh, that's the one.
Yeah, we talk about dance competition shows like Dancing with the Stars and Strictly Come Dancing and some other shows if we're able to find them and watch them in a format that we can watch.
Wait, we need to unwrap this.
Okay.
This is breaking news to me.
This is – all of the podcasts that I do or have done, we kind of lump under the name Teal Productions.
Yeah.
The teal – besides being a color, obviously, is a combination of the first and middle initials of both of our names. Her name is Terry Ann, and mine is Edward Lee. And so it coincidentally can spell teal.
You're blowing my mind right now.
Hang on. This is exactly what the couch is for, man. Settle it. Settle it. We're going good here. It was the first show that we really started – recording and putting out there was Dance Fever. It is over 250 episodes, I think we've gotten in so far. So, and actually we haven't started recording, but we've been watching this current season of Dancing with the Stars, which is a sports theme. It's going to be the show is going to be four episodes, and we'll probably just talk about all of those in one podcast.
Nice.
And then we'll wait until the end of May, I think, for the start of So You Think You Can Dance, the end of June, she says. So that is the real start of my podcasting career, was Dance Fever.
See, I'm so glad that I have you on, because whenever I talk to you, it's always on Twitter, and it's always about comics.
Yes, it is.
So it's nice to see that you're a nice human person.
I'm not a comic bot. Plug in the correct words and you get the appropriate response.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, there are those people.
Oh.
Those people do exist. And they might be real people, but they sure don't act like it.
Yeah, they appear kind of bot-like.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I was listening to Mighty Thorcast today.
Oh, cool.
I was behind on a bunch of stuff, so yeah. Very cool. And then you do the... Are you still doing the Usagi podcast? I hadn't seen that in a while.
Yeah, I've been on a break on it. I hit kind of just a wall, and so I just stepped back a little bit to re-energize, I guess. But yeah, it's not one that I've retired. The Ronin Rabbit. And then I do a Dr. Fate called Lords of Order, which is also kind of in the same position as Ronin Rabbit right now. It's kind of sitting idling over to the side a bit.
Well, Dr. Fate's kind of in a weird spot, right?
As far as currently, yes.
Yeah.
And I've been meaning to read it, and I haven't. He apparently did like a 5 or 6 issue recurring thing in the Blue Beetle book that maybe it just got canceled. I'm not sure what its status is.
Yeah, fairly recently, yeah.
Yeah, it he was in that. And then I was listening to a podcast today, and they were talking about Dr. Fate appearing in the new JLA book, that came out maybe yesterday? Was there one that came out yesterday?
Dude, listen, I read like two issues of that and I said, I can't do this.
Yeah, okay.
I can't.
Yeah, whatever the big jumping off is now going to be after Metal, where they're going to have their four JLA teams with all these weird people in them. And
yeah.
I think that storyline, the first issue of that was like maybe yesterday or maybe last week. And apparently Dr. Fate was in it. So I need to look at that and see so I can just keep track of where he is and what he's doing.
See, maybe you should check it out. I quit doing it because I'm not a Lobo fan. I don't know how you feel about Lobo.
Yeah.
So
I agree.
I was like, this is kind of a mess. I'm going to leave it. But I know Promethea was on JLA a couple months ago.
Oh, really?
I meant to pick it up because I thought it was curious. Let me tell you, Alan Moore must be like the angriest person in the world. It's no wonder he quits comics every 3 months, you know?
Yeah.
Because first they do all this Watchmen stuff, which, I mean, that's a repeat, right? Because we had that before Watchmen stuff years ago.
Right.
And now you've got the, what's it called? Doomsday Clock.
Right.
And then, Tom Strong is in The Terrifics.
Right.
And then Promethea was in JLA. So you know he's like, F these guys.
Oh, yeah.
I'm never even looking at a comic ever again in my life.
If he even knows, he may be so sequestered somewhere doing some kind of, witchcrafty kind of thing. Not that there's a problem with that, mind you.
Sure.
But, you know, it's a very curious lifestyle compared to the one I lead. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, I always imagine Alan Moore living in like in a swamp. He's like Swamp Thing, you know. He just hangs out in the green all day long.
Yeah, exactly. And doing what swamp things do, I guess. You know, trying to reconcile the giant sized man thing. I guess I don't know.
Was that a sexual reference?
No, not at all. That was actually the title of the book. I didn't do that. They did that. That wasn't me.
Poor Alan Moore. He was doing interesting stuff over at on Avatar Press.
And every now and then I think he still has some stuff running over there, but you never hear about it.
Oh, I thought they had quit publishing.
There's something. It's right on the edge of the brain, and it's just not coming to me. But it's a title that I had seen, like, bi-monthly that continued to have his name attached as the writer.
No kidding. Because I know that they had, I think the only one that was still going was Cinema Purgatorio.
Okay, was there one, like, Providence or
yeah,
something like that?
Yeah, you're right. Providence.
Okay. Yeah, Cinema Purgatorio, I took advantage of their Kickstarter and got kind of stiffed on it, so I quit paying attention to it.
Yeah, I have a tough time doing Kickstarters. Every once in a while, I'll do a few. I just backed, damn it. I saw the one that you put on Twitter, I think it was yesterday, the Crimson Rider? I'm backing that. Salvagers. There's a new Salvagers Kickstarter.
Oh, okay, go and take a look at that.
I don't know if you're a Red Salvagers, but they've been doing that for years.
Yeah, I've read just about all of them. So, yeah, and I have – Kickstarter has gotten to the point for me where if the creator admits on Kickstarter that they already have a publisher, I don't have anything to do with it because I have not had one of those work out in my favor.
No kidding.
Yeah, so now if it's just a creator and they're doing their stuff and it's all going to be on Kickstarter, I'll give it a look and seriously, you know, think about it. But if it's somebody that comes in and says, you know, hey, I'm trying to get this going with Red Anvil or Anvil 5 or whatever the name of that company is or something, I back off no matter how cool it looks. I'm like, no, because when publishers get involved, their job is not to keep me happy.
Yeah.
Their job is to make money.
Yeah.
And so customer service is not as high a priority as it is with that creator who wants to get their product out there.
Yeah, I try not to – I'll only back Kickstarters from people I don't know.
Okay.
Aside from like Salvagers, which it was so funny. I didn't get to go to C2E2 this year, but I went last year, and we were walking around, and Bob Sally was there, the writer for Salvagers, and he was super. I love when people have high energy at a convention, you know.
Right.
Because it means that they really want to shill out their product.
They're trying.
Yeah, they're trying. I hate when people just sit behind a table and just, like, you know, like, sketch on their book all day.
Right.
Like, if you don't make eye contact, chances are nobody's going to talk to you. But he was out on the front of the table, and Ronnie and I walked past, and he's like, yeah. He started talking about Salvagers, and I was like, oh, yeah. I was like, I read the book. He's like, you did? I said, yeah. I was like, I reviewed it for – I used to do written reviews for a couple websites. I was like, yeah, I reviewed it on this site. And he's like, wait, you were the guy that totally shit on it, right? And I was like, no.
Yikes.
Yeah, I was like, no, that wasn't me. So I ended up buying the trade from him, even though I already had all the issues. I was like, eh, whatever.
There you go.
Yeah, the guy's here, might as well.
Supporting. That's the way all of that should work, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, there's two creators that I really follow on Kickstarter. One is Steve Bryant, who does Athena Voltaire.
Mm, yeah.
I will follow Athena to the end of the earth. So I'm right there with Steve every time he does something on Kickstarter. Well, every time he does something with Athena anywhere, as a matter of fact. And then the other one is Mr. Sean Pryor.
Oh, right.
Those are two of the probably most gentlemanly gentlemen in comic books, in my opinion, and I have nothing but support for both of those men.
Well, and you also know that those guys deliver, right?
Yes.
That's the key thing.
Yeah, well, yeah.
I've been fortunate enough to never be burned on Kickstarter.
Okay.
But there were a couple times where I wasn't sure if I was even going to get the thing, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I've been burned once, but I have probably five or six right now that are a year or more behind.
Oh, wow.
But they haven't officially canceled, so as far as I know, I'll get it, you know. But, yeah, I've only ever had one cancel, and I haven't seen my money back, if I will. I don't know. I mean, of course, it's not major money. It's kind of the principle of the thing.
Sure.
Yeah, so I've only been burned really once so far.
You would think if these guys are putting themselves out on a platform like Kickstarter, they would at least have most of the book finished, you know?
Well, yes. I mean, I agree with you. And then, you know, I'll get on somewhere, like say Twitter, and I'll start bitching about it and have people throw out some pretty good points. So I just kind of pull back and I'm like, yeah, you know, I guess that those things you're saying are possible. So I'll just chill a little bit and see what happens. But I agree with you. If for me, the way I look at it is we've made an agreement. I have agreed to give you X amount of whatever, in this case, it's money.
Mm-hmm.
And in exchange, you have agreed to give me a product, whatever that product would be, an issue of a comic book, we'll say. Now, at some point, really early in our relationship, you get my money.
Yeah.
So that means that you're kind of on the hook to deliver the product, because that was our agreement. And if you can't do that, there is a real hard-ass side of me that says, well, you broke our contract. I'm out. You know, I don't care what you do. That's fine. But, you know, yeah, things come up and people get sick and there are, you know, real life things that happen. Okay. The way I look at that is if you thought that that was going to happen, then you should have set up your procedure differently.
Mm-hmm.
Like you say, be 80% done with the project before you even put it on Kickstarter.
Right.
And so you don't need the money to finish, but you can use the money to finish.
Right.
You know, so – yeah, Kickstarter is starting to turn up for me when I think about it in the same way that eBay now sits with me.
Mm.
Used to be eBay was really good for us, the buyers.
Yep.
Now it has swung to where it is better for those people trying to make money off of it than those people trying to buy or find a good deal. Kickstarter is starting to make that shift. Every Kickstarter I look at wants me to pay $10 before shipping and handling for a 25 to 30 page comic book. I have a really hard and fast problem with that. Now they say, well, but you also get this PDF.
Yeah.
And of course my response is, well, I don't want the PDF. I want your printed product. And it's my understanding in going from idea to printed product, you probably make that PDF anyways, don't you?
Sure.
So what you're saying is that your added value is to include me in part of the process that you're doing to get me the final product, and I should smile and say thank you? I don't quite see it that way. No, $5 to $7, which still is more than we pay for just about anything else, as a standard price, you know? Okay, I'll do that. I'm supporting you in what you're doing, and I want to help. That's fine. But now, everybody, $10, printed book, PDF. And I'm like, I don't know.
Maybe some of these guys have tough luck finding a worthwhile printer. You know what I'm saying? Like somebody that can give them a good deal.
It could be. And I'm sure it has to be tied to volume, you know?
Yeah.
You know, they're not bringing 250,000 issues to be printed. They're bringing 200.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm not, you know, and this is all from my point of view. I'm sure if I was that person, I would have a different point of view on what happens and why the prices are what they are and everything like that. I can appreciate that. But there's this line, and on one side of the line is my problem, and on the other side of the line is your problem. And I try to stay on my problem side of the line. So,
yeah, I wonder what the relation is with the pricing on the Kickstarters, because you're right. Most of them are like $10 for an issue. And that's a little tough to swallow, you know, even at the high prices of comics now.
Right.
I mean, if it was like a 40 page comic, maybe, you know, because then you feel like you're getting more value for your dollar.
Sure, but more pages, or it's a hardcover, or there's any number of things that for the consumer, we could say, well, yeah, we'll pay for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of what it is, I always thought that when people set up Kickstarters, they set them up based on advice that they have gotten from other people that have done Kickstarters. And it seems to me the natural progression has been to that $10 book and PDF price point, because I didn't see it a couple years ago, maybe 3 years ago. You never saw it that high. But now virtually everybody, when they come out, has that.
But don't you think it makes it harder to actually fund a project when you're somebody that's never put out a book? And you're trying to do an issue for $10.
I've seen a lot, as far as I can tell, you know, on Kickstarter, of course, they tell you two things: if they have supported other Kickstarters and if they have done any other projects.
Mm-hmm.
And I have seen a fair share of people that are coming into it, not only at that price point, but they're getting funded because people want to help them, and they're. They feel that the product is interesting enough to warrant that price, so they're helping them out with that, and it's getting funded. So, you know, that's what makes me think that, well, maybe, you know, in the grand scheme of things, maybe my viewpoint is a little skewed, because even though I think that price is too high, it must not be for the market, because they're getting funded. So,
I suppose you're right. I suppose you're right. I do like when I don't even care about the more pages sometimes, really. But you know, like you mentioned, like being hardcover. I remember I did the what was it called? Beast of the Black Hand.
Okay.
The Ominous Kickstarter last year.
And, oh, okay. Right.
Yep. And it was I think it was only like 32 pages. 40 pages, something like that, but it was an oversized hardcover. And so I was more willing to pay the $25 that they asked for because it was an oversized hardcover.
But was that also helped by the creators involved, perhaps? Was that a Bart Sears?
I'm trying to think who worked on it. I think Ron Mars wrote it.
Okay, I was going to say, or was it the writer? I know that. So right there, you already have some idea of the product that you're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if you like Ron Mars, then you're like, okay, you know, I'm willing to do this. If you like Bart Sears as the artist and he was doing one, it would be, well, you know, for what they're giving me the price, but, you know, I know this creator and I dig their stuff, so I'll jump in and do that.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, that's true. I think the cover just kind of did it for me.
Okay. Well, there you go.
That might be what it was. You know, the cover really helps, man. I was talking to, you know, the guest that I had last week, BJ Memelson. Like he's got a very interesting cover on that book, and I don't know if like that was something he designed or the artist came up with or whatever. But you know, I think for somebody that wants to get attention, it's nice to have a nice cover. I mean, that's how you sell stuff on the shelves at a comic shop anyway, right?
Right, right.
But like if you're going to have something like an oversized hardcover where you might have it on your shelf as opposed to just you know, a 22-page floppy you stick in a box, it's definitely nicer to have some really creative art on the cover, maybe have a big name on the cover, and maybe that justifies the additional cost of the book also.
For a lot of people, I'm sure it would.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, you're looking at something like that and thinking, well, you know, $5 more than I would normally pay for that kind of book. Yeah, for that cover in that format, I can do that. That's cool. I'll get it.
Yep.
So yeah. But yeah, you're absolutely right. At comic shops, I mean, absolutely. That's why most things are displayed at least one cover up.
Right.
You know, and we us old timers complain all the time about, you know, I thought that was a really cool cover, and when I read the story, the two had nothing in common. Well, except the character, of course. The character wasn't, but it's like that scene never happened. They never fought so and so. You know, back in the day, you pick up an Avengers book, and that cover was an actual panel from somewhere in the story.
Right, right, right.
And you know, that's because even back then they knew that, you know, of course the dynamism of the cover would sell the book, but nowadays they have just taken that all the way to extremes and said, we're going to do it just to sell the book. We're going to, you know, we're going to pay someone, I don't know what covers are, $300 to draw a cover. Is that cheap? I don't know. Sounds like a lot to me, but
I don't even know. I mean, when they sell the covers, they go for about $500 in many cases.
So yeah, so you know, somebody's being paid, and half the time I have no doubts that the whoever the editor, I would assume, that gets in touch and just says, do up a cover of this, and doesn't tell them what's going on in the story, so the poor artist didn't know.
yeah, that's true. I think it depends, though, too, because I know that there's people that complained when there were reused panels as covers.
Okay,
I know in particular it's happened with, like, variant covers, like, you know, 1 in 10s or 1 in 20s.
Okay.
Where it's, like, literally the panel just blown up to cover size. Because what we used to have back in the day was it wouldn't be the exact panel always, but it would be like a different take on that panel, right? Maybe like from a different perspective or something like that.
Right, a different camera angle, let's
say. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yep. What I do miss is the word balloons on covers. That was the best.
Absolutely, man.
It was the best. Now it's just like, you know, you're going to the comic shop and you're like literally buying a piece of art. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Especially if it's a number one book where you've never read an issue before, you know nothing about it. Like, you're just buying it for the cover.
For the cover. And you're just hoping, you know, when you get home and read it, you're like, well, I thought it was going to be good and it was okay, so I'm safe.
Yeah.
You know.
But yeah, the Werber balloons were the best, man, because you got to know what was happening inside the book. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't plot points, but like there might be a joke in there, or like, I don't know, one character saying something snarky to another one, and you know, like, oh, these two guys are gonna meet.
You're not gonna trick me again, Doc Ock. You know, so you're like, oh well, he must have got him once already in the book when I read it. So okay,
yeah,
cool stuff like that. Now you get pretzel posed people and just, yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I blame Valiant for all that stuff. I do, man. You know, they're the ones that started all that crap back in the 90s.
In the night with the platinum gold sparkly die cut covers.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true, man. It's true. Well, they ruined it.
I laugh because I was third in line every time to pick up one of those. So I can't bitch too hard. I can see in retrospect what that did, but at the time I was that problem. So, I can't be too hard on that.
I was too. I mean, I'm joking. Obviously I love Valiant.
Absolutely.
Maybe not as much as I used to, but I still love Valiant. But you know, the first non-Marvel and DC book that I bought was X-Men Manowar Zero, and that was the very first ever Chromium cover.
Right.
That's why I bought it, because it was shiny on the shelf.
Yep.
And then the story just happened to be really good, so it kind of worked out.
Yeah, you got lucky.
Yeah, I got really lucky on that one. But you know, that led me into many different branching paths, and I don't think I'd be reading as much indie stuff as I do now if it wasn't for the fact that I took a chance on a shiny cover.
Sure, sure.
But those things are few and far between, you know?
Yeah. Now they are, because there's so much out there that, yeah, if you truly don't know when you reach for that book, you are really taking a chance.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, you know, art, story. Is there going to even be an issue next month if you do like it?
Oh, yeah.
You know, so it's, yeah, it's, there are things to say positively about the way that a couple really large publishing companies put out their comic books right now. I'm not the biggest fan of either of the big two currently, but I read my share of their books as well. So I guess, once again, any problem that I have, I am part of that problem. So
true, but at the same time, you're also one of those people that is willing to try other stuff.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I can't understand why there aren't more people like that, at least just willing to try. You know, not even necessarily just keep trying. Just, you know, if you just keep hammering away, you'll find one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's going to get kind of expensive long term. I certainly can see that. But take a chance. You know, some upstart company, a Vault or an Aftershock or a new Boom title. It take a chance. Pick it up, take it home, read it, and see. And if not, fine. There's, you know, of course, no obligation to ever do it again, but take the shot.
Yeah, I think the problem is, well, there's a couple problems, really. Number one, I think the people that are willing to take the shot are going to be old farts like us, because, yeah, you know, A, we have more disposable income than somebody that's in high school, and B, we've probably been reading comics for 20, 30, 40 years and want something else.
Okay. Well, yeah, that certain, wow, that really fits me. I'm not sure if that's good or bad, but yeah, okay. I'm there.
Well, I mean, like, you're a little bit older than I am, but you know, in the, I don't even know where we could start on that. I would say maybe into the late 80s, early 90s is when you start seeing a lot of new indie stuff popping in.
Yeah.
And I mean, that scene started much earlier, right? Like, even, I would say, even as far back as the late 70s.
To a much smaller scale, I think it really probably took off. The breadth of the offering really took off in like the mid 80s.
Yeah.
And that's not the black and white boom, notwithstanding. Sure. I'm not even thinking about those, but that just that did it too. But that was an artificial inflation that contracted pretty quickly after about 3 years or 4 years. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, in the mid 1980s, you know, when you had first comics and Kimiko, when you had Cerebus coming out, ElfQuest, you know, just it kept getting broader and broader, and it has stayed pretty broad until now. I mean, you've got a whole daggone catalog that half of it is other publishing companies besides Marvel and DC. So, I mean, you know, it's as you have as big an offering now across all the companies probably as you have ever had at any time.
Yeah, I was looking at numbers yesterday, sales numbers, and I hate looking at numbers because, you know, those numbers don't mean anything. Because, you know, I'm sure a lot of those books just end up sitting on a shelf anyway.
Right.
Right? That's what we have, long boxes that you can go diving into. But, you know, I do wonder if the increase in sales, like the positive gains over the last 15, 20 years, isn't because of the large amount of new and up-and-coming publishers coming in and trying new things.
There has to be a percentage that is because of that, surely, because if not, then those books wouldn't be selling at all because those brand new people would be buying Marvel and DC.
Yeah.
So we would see their numbers going up and up and up, but it seems like either people are just flat out trying these other things, or they were Marvel and DC, and recently they thought, well, let's see what else is out there.
See, that's something interesting that I was thinking about, and I've been thinking about that for a few days. Like, maybe the reason why the top-selling book is generally at, like, 100,000 copies, where it used to be, I don't know, let's say 2 million copies, is because instead of having 500 books now we have, like, 1,000 books out.
I certainly think that's what's going on. You know, everybody has, say, $30 to spend.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of all 30 going to Marvel, 10 go to Marvel and 20 goes elsewhere.
Yeah.
You know, it's still the same amount of money, but now it's spread out. And so it looks like these, you know, these other companies are selling these, selling at competitive numbers. When I think what it is that people are just spreading the money out because things other than superheroes are grabbing their attention.
Do you think that the rise of, like, internet culture has kind of allowed that to happen? Because I'm trying to think, like, back when I first started reading comics, the only way that I knew what was coming out was either when I went to a shop and heard somebody talking about it, or the shop owner told me about it, or on the off chance that I had a friend that I went to school with that read comics, which even back then was rare. I'm sure now it's even rarer. And then the other way was Wizard. And I mean, Wizard did some stuff talking about indies, but it was generally like a very select few. Like, they always talked about Bone, for example.
Right.
But not really much else, you know? There were, matter of fact, they were always up Valiant's ass. It was Valiant all the time.
I think that the internet probably is the current word of mouth. You know, people always talk about having to get their product out there via word of mouth. And I think that's now, that's Facebook likes and Twitter retweets and stuff like that. Because if you think about it, there really isn't a print culture magazine like Wizard anymore.
Yeah.
So that format, that way of getting the word out is gone. The only thing that now is out there is quote unquote social media, is the, you know, the 21st century word of mouth. So that has to be the way that people are finding out things. Now, I will say that back in the early 90s that we were talking about. That's where I first ran across this wonderful publication called Previews Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
I have purchased it since then, even during those times that I wasn't buying comic books, just to keep up on what was going on.
Mm.
So I probably consistently purchased Previews is my longest comic book related thing that I have purchased. I mean, even, you know, long runs of comics that I have, I stopped and when I picked back up, I had to go back and do the back issue thing. Previews I've been buying consistently probably since 94 or 95.
Can you imagine if they sold bags and boards for Previews magazines?
Oh, my goodness.
How ridiculous would that look?
Oh, there, you know that there are people that keep those.
Oh, I'm sure.
I and this may be, you know, I may be cursing here, but I throw mine away every month. When I get the new one, the old one's gone.
So I don't get them anymore, but I was for a long time. And I didn't do month to month, but I would keep them like 3 or 4 months.
Okay.
Because, you know, like you're getting the previews way in advance anyway.
Right. Yeah.
So I would generally keep it until the books that were in that previews actually came out.
That makes
and
sense.
And then
yeah.
I get rid of it.
Okay. Yeah.
Because, I mean, I would mark it down and stuff, you know.
Yeah. It makes it easier to keep up with what you want to get, what you've told someone you want to get, you know, whatever the situation is. It's just easier to do because you went through and marked that puppy up anyway. So yeah.
You know, I'm a big tech nerd, but I do like to do analog things once in a while.
Oh, previews is the bomb, man. There is nothing cooler for me than that Wednesday when I go to my shop and I come back with that. It goes on the top of my stack, and that's the way I read. By the way, I read. What I want to read most is top of stack down to the bottom of the stack. So previews goes right on top. That's the first thing I pick up from that Wednesday. I probably won't go all the way through it because I still want to read my comic book. But, you know, I'll look through it. Maybe I'll flip through and page through the toys. I want to see what cool pops they have in this month or something like that. I'll lay it down and then I'll start reading my comics and you know, go back and forth to the previews for the rest of that month.
Because you're talking about your pile. How do you determine your reading order out of curiosity?
What I want to read most, I read first. That's easy for me to do because if I don't want to read it or I don't think I'm going to read it, I didn't buy it and bring it home.
Hmm.
You know, there's some people who will tell you, well, the thing I want to read, you know, the least I want to read is on the bottom of my stack. And my thinking is, well, then if you potentially didn't want to read it, why did you buy it?
Well, not just that. If it's at the bottom of the stack and you didn't want it, you're never going to read it.
Well, yeah, really. It'll stay there. And next week you'll put more stuff on top of it. And yeah. So, but yeah, that's what I, you know, over time it got to the point where, you know, really, if I had any question, I just don't buy it because if I change my mind later, I can always get it or get the trade or go to Comixology now or Marvel Unlimited or, you know, it's too easy to make up for the fact that potentially I made a mistake by not getting a book several months ago.
Yep.
So, yeah. So the thing I want to read is the very first thing off my pile. That's what I read first.
Yeah, and you know what I don't understand is, so I'll usually make a list, right? And so I know what I'm getting ahead of time. I still do DCBS for a lot of stuff, so, you know, it's ordered ahead of time. It's already paid for. I don't even worry about it. You know, the box shows up, I open it up, and it's like Christmas every week.
Oh, yeah.
But I do buy a lot of digital comics because I'm reading a lot more indie stuff, and I feel more comfortable waiting until those come out on Comixology, and I get those that way.
Okay.
But what I find curious is that not every indie publisher does digital comics, which doesn't make sense to me.
It seems to me like they're really taking a chance of not – it's almost a definite that they won't sell as many product, as much product, if they do that. If they just rely solely on the physical printing, they're completely missing out on a whole segment of the market.
Well, I would say missing out on the majority of the market. Because if you're a small indie publisher, the chances of a shop carrying your book is much smaller, first of all.
Absolutely. Okay. True,
right?
True.
Because there are shops that are like Marvel and DC exclusive, or like they'll sell Kirkman stuff.
Right.
But it's Marvel and DC. Like, that's where you go. And then you have good shops that will have, you know, a wide variety of things. But I think about like Scout Comics, for example, which I understand is a very small publisher.
Yes.
You know, I can get the books locally, but not always, a good chunk of the time. But I know for a large chunk of the country, you can't get them at a comic shop because the shops won't order them.
Right.
And they don't have anything available in Comixology. Now, I can go to the Sky Comics website and order from their store, but I don't want to do that. I want the comic now. You know what I'm saying? Like, why isn't right. First of all, yeah. Why isn't that in my shop? And second of all, why can't I just go on Comixology and give you $2.99, $3.99, or whatever?
Right.
Right? Because as you mentioned earlier, if they're publishing these books, they have a PDF of the book.
I would think any kind of digital product nowadays has to be part of the process.
Absolutely.
How do you get that book to the printer? do you actually FedEx a paper copy? No. You know, so it's like there has to be a digital copy that you could use for that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, stuff like that I don't get, man. I don't get. There's a book that I really like from Scout, Heavenly Blues. I think the last issue comes out next week. And it was tough getting a few of them. And the thing is, I know that they have digital copies because I've talked to the writer many a times, and he sent me PDF copies of his book.
Oh, wow. Okay. Dude. Yeah. Yeah. I guess on some level, it must be a business decision, but I would really be curious to sit in on that meeting and find out what it was that prompted them to decide not to go digital on say a Comixology.
Yeah.
What made you decide that? How is that better for you?
And the thing is, I mean, these are actual publishers, right? So like if somebody, so on this podcast, I've had two people that submitted books, their own self-published works to Comixology submit. Okay. And as I've learned, the process is a freaking nightmare.
Oh, okay.
Okay, because you need to send the pages out. There's a human that reviews to make sure that the guidelines are correct because, you know, you have to do it for different screen sizes and this and that. If you're doing at multiple countries, you have to have different languages and they have to be translated properly, all this and that. So as a result, there are times when releasing those books will be delayed because Comixology has to manually approve them. Right? There's not like as much money as Amazon has, there's not an AI like sorting through these books. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah.
There's still a human being there. But for a publisher that has their books listed in previews through Diamond, I don't think that would be a problem.
I guess we must not understand a part of the process, I guess.
Sounds to me like I need to get somebody from Scout in here and find out what the deal is.
Absolutely. I would love to hear why they say. I am completely in that boat with a publisher in Massachusetts called they publish The Tick, New England Comics.
Oh, right.
They do not put The Tick out in digital. Now, admittedly, that is the only book they're putting out right now.
Sure.
But The Tick has been around since the early 90s. I mean, it's a known quantity. But they don't it's a print or nothing so far for all of their stuff. They don't even have back stuff in digital. You can buy trades. You can buy the current floppy.
Hmm.
Oh, I hate that word. I want to wash my mouth out now. But there is no digital of anything for The Tick out there, legitimately.
Interesting.
From the publisher. So Yeah, I would really like to know from someone, why not? What, you know, what's the problem with that process that is so restrictive that you guys felt that you couldn't do that?
So, I mean, the only thing I can think of is if you put it on Comixology, Comixology's getting like 70% of the sale price.
Okay,
so it's a much larger chunk than if you did it print through Diamond. Because, you know, Diamond takes a very small percentage.
Right.
I don't know what the actual number is, but I think it's like 10%. And if you're publishing through, like, Image, for example, they take another chunk also. So in the end, you do have a minority that you're getting. But, I mean, at least you have the book out, you know?
Well, I guess they're dealing with such thin margin to begin with that they can't absorb that.
I guess, man. But let me tell you, digital files are infinitely reproducible, and it's free to do that. You know, copy and paste.
Well, and you know, I have heard people say that is why some publishers don't release in digital, is because they're concerned about pirating.
Yeah, but if someone's going to pirate it, they're going to find a way to get it. You see what I'm saying?
Well, yeah. I mean, to me, that even though it sounds legitimate, and it may actually have a you know, there may be a measurable bite for those people financially on the back end, the fact that they produce something at all means that it will be pirated.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, are you telling me that your concern is the money that you'll lose there when you're losing money on your product already because you're, you know, so you know, explain it to me is what I would like somebody to be able to sit down and do. Just explain why you're not using digital today. 20 years ago, I understand completely. But today.
I agree. All right, Ed. It is time for you to be put on the hot seat.
Uh-oh. Okay.
Now, I know you're a big Usagi fan. I told you that maybe we'd do Usagi trivia. Guess what we're not doing? We're not doing Usagi trivia. Instead, okay. We're doing Thor trivia.
Thor? Okay.
Now, you are an expert in Thor, so most of these questions will probably be very easy for you.
Uh-oh. Okay. No pressure.
If you win this week's competition, you get no prize. So I hope you win.
Me too.
Here we go. We'll kick it off easy. What is the name of Thor's enchanted hammer?
I believe that some folks would pronounce that Mjolnir.
I like it. Now for extra credit, and I don't know how well you speak Old Norse.
Okay.
But do you know what Mjolnir stands or means? What it translates to?
I would say storm.
Ooh. All right, we're gonna phone a friend, and your friend is me.
Okay.
It literally stands for hammer.
Oh, cool. Okay.
It means that which smashes.
Okay.
All right. See, you learned something new. Congratulations.
I did.
I'll give you the point on that. In Norse mythology, what event was foretold to result in the death of Thor?
Ragnarok.
Competing bells. This is, what is it, like dueling banjos, but with bells.
Okay.
Which of Thor's comrades is the son of nine mothers?
The son of nine mothers.
Ooh, tough one.
Yeah, I can't say off the top of my head that I recall that reference. So let me see. I'm going to take a shot, and I'll say Loki.
Oh, so close. It's Heimdall.
Yeah, that's not really close, but okay. Heimdall. Heimdall is the son of nine mothers. And in your research, did you find the explanation as to why?
Well, you know, mythology is a weird thing. The weirder thing is that all nine of his mothers are sisters.
Okay, maybe we shouldn't talk about this live. that's getting kind of, yeah. Okay, all right.
Who was the first Marvel character outside of the Norse pantheon to be deemed worthy to wield Thor's hammer?
Ooh, Thor's hammer. I don't know that this goes back far enough, but I'll say Beta Ray Bill.
The greatest Thor of all time. No, you disagree, don't you?
I like the Norse dude, blonde-haired, blue-eyed guy. You know, although I will say, it's interesting that you should bring that up because that ties in to this latest Marvel movie, Avengers Infinity.
Indeed it does.
And that's all I'm going to say for fear of giving anything away. I don't want to spoil anything for anyone, but as soon as they said that, I remember bending over to my wife and saying, hey, that's Beta Ray's hammer. So.
Yes. I was like, wait, is Beta Ray in this movie?
Oh, I was hoping there for a minute. That would be awesome because nobody had said that. I was like, yes, but no, not this one. So.
In Norse mythology, what animals pull Thor's chariot?
A pair of goats.
Indeed. Do you know the names of the goats?
Tooth Gnasher and Tooth Grinder.
Wow. That is impressive.
And don't ask me what the Norse names are because I don't know if I know.
I don't know either.
I'm sure they must have Norse names, but yeah.
I wonder if this is you read Rough Riders, right?
Yes.
Are you reading the current series?
Yes.
Aren't the Boken Riders like kind of like this?
That's what I felt, yeah.
Yeah, okay, cool. Just making sure.
Yeah, that was the impression that I got, sure.
What is the name of Thor's mortal love interest?
Jane Foster.
Which, I guess she's not mortal anymore, huh?
Well, perhaps she is, just in another dimension. So
yeah.
It's kind of ambiguous as to exactly what the situation is there, but
it is. I mean, maybe she just can't age in this other realm.
I was going to say, either way, I think the situation is that she is no longer being debilitated by cancer.
True.
And anything beyond that is perhaps left to our imagination until they decide to settle it later.
Agreed. What artist drew Thor in his Marvel debut?
In the artist's Marvel debut or in Thor's Marvel debut?
Thor's Marvel debut.
I believe that was Jack Kirby.
Jack Kirby is correct.
Yes, the King. And it was not in Thor's title. It was in The Journey into Mystery.
That's correct. Number 83.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. They didn't have a proto-Thor, did they? Because didn't they have like a proto-Iron Man? They had a proto-Doctor Strange?
Yes, I don't believe they – because, I mean, Thor is something that they could just pull right out of
– yeah, that's true.
You know, right out of history. And so I guess that's what they did, whereas the other creations had to be created to begin with. And so you had more, primitive attempts, and then it was refined and – we know it today as something a little different.
Mm-hmm. All right. Give me the names of the Warriors Three.
The Warriors Three. That would be Volstagg, Hogun the Grim, and Fandral.
Very nice. What ritual must Odin observe once a year to regain his strength?
The Odin sleep.
Man, you are on fire. What is the Asgardian name for the earthly plane?
Midgard.
Midgard is correct. Final question.
All right.
Who played Thor in the 1988 television movie The Incredible Hulk Returns?
I have no idea. I've seen it. I have no idea who the dude was.
You have no idea is correct. It's His name is Eric Allen Kramer.
Kramer. Okay, now I will remember that if it ever comes up again.
Yeah, he was in... Oh, God, what was he in? That's like a Disney Channel show for a while. Did you ever see that movie, by the way?
Oh, yeah. I've seen it.
There are so many memes on the internet from that movie. It's amazing.
I'm a huge fan of the Hulk series from that time period.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe there was one or maybe two telemovies that they were in together as those characters. So all I can say is you got to keep in mind when those things were made.
Oh, yeah.
It's, you know, plus it was for TV, so.
That's true.
Let's reduce the budget even that much more, you know, so, okay.
So are you excusing the David Hasselhoff, Nick Fury? Is that what you're doing right now?
I do appreciate Hasselhoff in Knight Rider, yes. In Nick Fury, and in Baywatch, I don't even talk about Baywatch. And Baywatch Nights isn't even on my radar, so
I forgot about Baywatch Nights.
Remember? Oh yeah, that was. They wanted to get all dark and put it on later in the night.
Mm-hmm.
Baywatch Nights.
Ah, the good old days.
I don't even know how many episodes that was. It wasn't many.
I don't think it lasted a full season.
No, I don't think so either.
Oh, man. All right, Ed, it's been a pleasure chatting with you. Why don't you tell these wonderful listeners where they can go stalk you?
Probably the best place to find me is on Twitter, Teal, T-E-A-L Productions, all one word. And I'm probably on there. And even if I'm not on there, I have, like most people, the announcements on my phone so that if somebody tweets at me at any time that I want to respond, I'll get the message and stuff, you know.
Yeah. Yep. Twitter is also the best place to find me because Twitter is the best. This show is not sponsored by Twitter. Shame on Twitter. But you can find me at Geekvine, and there's no show Twitter. I'm over that. No more show Twitters for me. Just find me directly, or you can email comictalktoday@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in. I'll be back tomorrow.